Hi, welcome to this week's program. Setting up a rainy day fund for lost income and unpredictable emergencies is a concept that most of us get on the face of it, but which remains rather vague in practice. Not only that, but a disturbingly large number neglect to follow through on setting aside enough money, whether it's from not knowing how much they ought to reserve or because they find it difficult to make the necessary sacrifice to fund it. If you fall into one of these camps, I'm going to help you today by walking you through some of the considerations that go into defining how much you should save for your emergency fund and how to meet your target goal and then separate that money away from your spending budget. Before we begin, however, let's get one kind of obvious thing out of the way that applies to everyone. Credit cards are never a good substitute for an emergency fund. One of the first factors you need to look at is whether you're currently earning a paycheck or living primarily on savings. If you're employed, you can probably get away with a minimum recommendation of most financial planners of putting aside 3 months of your current salary, or if you're a freelancer or work in a cyclical industry, maybe 6 months. This is to cover basic items in your household budget: housing, food, utilities, bills, and so on. Even if you're eligible for unemployment benefits, it's smart to put cash towards an emergency fund. There's no such thing as being too prepared for whatever eventualities might come up. Now, if you're retired and living on withdrawals from your retirement savings accounts, maybe supplemented by Social Security, you're going to want to save a much larger amount, enough to cover 1 to 2 years of spending so you don't have to withdraw from your long-term savings. The main reason for the bigger size of this fund is that you don't want to be forced to sell off assets from your retirement accounts at the same time you encounter a bad stock market. This number should reflect the amount you're spending minus Social Security and any other income sources. Now, this might seem like a pretty big hill to climb, which is why you need to be socking money away during as many of your working years as possible. Even if you're a disciplined saver, peeling off savings from your paycheck, it will take several years to build up 2 years' worth of income. And you can add to this savings by keeping some of your investments in short-term bonds and cash as well. You just don't only have to use money markets. If you're certain what your monthly expenses really are, there are lots of online budget calculators and most likely tools even from your bank that can help. Certain items might be amortized to a monthly average. For example, if you spend $1,000 a year on clothes, you want to add 1/12 of it, you know, $83 a month, to your monthly budget instead of ignoring that spending just because it occurs erratically. This also applies to restaurants and entertainment, travel costs, automobile expenses, gift givings. You get the idea. A side benefit to thinking about this stuff and writing it down in a monthly budget is you might find some areas where you can cut back, some areas where perhaps you're really wasting some money. Now, assuming you're still working, the follow-up question to ask yourself is, how consistent is my income? If you're a freelancer or work in the so-called gig economy where you're pulling in income from many different sources, or you're in a business that goes through regular cycles of expansion and contraction, and what I mean here is that if you're paid by the hour and your hours fluctuate a lot over a period of months or years, you're going to want to set aside more money in your emergency fund. It's critical to avoid withdrawing money from your retirement accounts if you face a period of unemployment. First off, you're essentially robbing from your own future if you do that. It's within the realm of possibility that $10,000 taken out today will cost you nearly $100,000 in savings many, many decades down the road. Secondly, something you never hear people talk about is if you work in a cyclical industry and are laid off, it is possible the stock market won't be doing too well either, so you might be forced to withdraw retirement savings at the very worst time, just when the market was selling at a low value. Now, on a more positive note, if you're part of a dual-income family, you can get away with a smaller emergency fund because it's unlikely that you and your partner will both yourselves be unemployed at the same time. Of course, use common sense. It doesn't apply if you're both freelancers or work at the same company that's going through a big round of layoffs. All right, so far we've just talked about emergency funds as replacement for lost income to cover consistent expenses. A more precise budget would include amounts for unexpected major expenses like a sudden medical bill, expensive car repairs, or a family emergency that requires travel and hotel costs. determine a kind of ballpark figure for how much one of these scenarios might cost, and add that to your income replacement figure. So, how quickly do you need to build up your emergency reserves? The short answer, as fast as you can. 20% of your paycheck is a good target to shoot for. Now, granted, this is quite a large amount. If you can't get there or can only reserve that much every so often, anything is obviously better than nothing. But try to use 20% as a benchmark until you reach your goal. You'll be delightfully surprised at how fast the money accumulates into something that you can be proud of, not to mention the peace of mind you'll feel having attained some financial and emotional security. There is, however, one key caveat to all I've said here today. Don't start saving until you pay down your expensive debts first. And here's a caveat to that caveat. Don't include your mortgage debt in this pay down equation. Not unless for some reason you're paying mortgage interest of 7% in a market where the average is around 4%. Another necessary detail on the pragmatic side of all this is make sure to segregate your emergency cash from your regular checking and savings accounts. Always set up a separate deposit account for your emergency fund. Is there such a thing as an emergency fund that is too big? Yeah, there is. If you exceed the guidelines I've laid out here by multiple thousands of dollars, perhaps that money ought to be moved over to your long-term investing and savings accounts. You don't want too much money sitting around earning practically nothing, right? So one more thing. I want to state again. Even if you never have to draw down on your emergency fund, you'll be rewarded for your hard work in the form of emotional security and the knowledge that you're truly on the road to financial independence. And attaining this level of money maturity will have a very powerful and positive influence on the quality of life you will lead. Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. With me today is the New York Times best-selling author of the book named the Best Investment Book of 2017. Author Daniel Crosby joins me to discuss his newest book, The Behavioral Investor, which is an applied look at how psychology ought to inform the art and science of investment management. Daniel was named one of the 12 thinkers to watch by Monster.com, and as a financial blogger, you should be reading, so says AARP. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What makes us strong as human beings makes us weak money and financial managers for ourselves. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, that's a big part of the first part of the book, talks about things that have served us well evolutionarily make us poor investors. So an easy example of this would be loss aversion. So, you know, if we go back thousands of years, we weren't the only humans on the block. We weren't the only human species on the block. We had a group called the Hobbits in Indonesia. We had the Neanderthals, which we're perhaps more familiar with in Europe, the Denisovans in Asia. And the reason why scientists believe that we outlasted these different groups of humans is that we were more fearful. Mm. We were basically more cowardly or more chicken than some of the other folks who were there. And so where they were sort of brave and overconfident and might have taken some sort of unprotected risks, we Homo sapiens were a little more fearful. And if things started to look dicey, we moved on. Uh-huh. So this loss aversion is what caused us to spread, what caused us to spread our genes and live on long enough to reproduce. And so it's been a great boon for us as a species, but it makes us a poor investor. And that's one of many examples that are covered in the book.
A statistic that I continually hear, and I actually continue to say, is that we feel the pain of a loss 2 times as much as we feel the pleasure of a gain. You subscribe to that, and do you think that's part of what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's nearly 2.5 times as much. I absolutely subscribe to it on anecdotal and experimental means. You know, I was at a casino recently. I was speaking at a casino of all places to speak about great investment decisions, and it was part of a hedge fund conference. And my family was there with me, so we retired early, but some of these, you know, hedge fund managers were out doing their thing late into the night. So the next day at the conference, I speak to these enormously wealthy guys and say, you know, hey, how'd you do at the tables last night? One of them says, I was up $500, and I say, oh, good for you. And he goes, doesn't change my life. And another gentleman to my right was down about an equal amount. And I said, oh, you know, get them next time sort of thing. And he said, no, this trip is ruined.
You know? Oh,
and this is, you know, this is an enormously wealthy, yeah. I won't name names, but yeah. This is an enormously wealthy individual. Yeah. And losing $500 was,
that's more ego.
You know, ruining the whole trip for him.
Yeah, so that's more ego. When you talk about ego in the book, this fear drives us to poor decision-making. As this quote in your book, in times of financial stress, people lose 13% of their IQ. That seems pretty, at a pretty amazing statistic. What does that do to us?
So I would give the caveat as well that not all of us have 13% to spare, right? So to give, yeah. So yeah, we found that when people are under financial duress, their cognitive processing power drops pretty significantly, which is, you know this as an advisor, we have least access to our financial knowledge when we need it most.
Right.
So at the very moment, we need to be remembering the good lessons that we've read about or learned from an advisor, we have least access to them. And this is a very consistent finding that, you know, at the very moment of struggle, your brain is out the door, your willpower is out the door, you know, your emotions are out the door. So this is why I'm such a big advocate for automating, you know, automating your investment life, automating your good decisions, and B, outsourcing and working with a financial professional.
The backup to this idea was studies that looked at the decision-making of judges who were hungry before sentencing and people who fast. Tell us briefly about that.
So it looked at different points during a day, and it was a study done on Israeli judges over a 10-month time period. It looked at over 1,100 different cases, and it mapped either the stringency or the leniency of the judges' rulings at different points during the day and tried to see if they were basically making consistent decisions through the course of the day. What they found is early in the morning, you start with about a 65% chance of being paroled. But if you're the last person seen right before lunch, you have a next to zero chance of being paroled because the judges are hungry and they're feeling hangry, as we say here in the Deep South, right? Mm-hmm. They're hungry and angry. They're feeling punitive. Then after they eat lunch, we jump up again to about 60, 65%, and that continues to decline until snack time when it jumps up again, and then it falls for the rest of the day. So again, the point I'm trying to make here is this. If you ask these judges, you know, how did you arrive at these decisions? they would point to, you know, their big brains and their years of learning and judicial precedent and any host of things besides not having had a donut and coffee, right? Yeah. They would point to a million different factors besides the most salient factor. And so all of us were possessed of these bodies that are, you know, consistent with the theme of our conversation today. We're presented with these bodies that are, on the one hand, miracles that are unrivaled by our best science, and on the other hand, get profoundly stupid if we just fail to eat enough. So we have to understand that our bodies, our brains, our society are all conspiring to lead us to make poor financial decisions.
We talked about ego before, overconfidence. People are especially more positive, you say, especially men, and this I really enjoyed, who when surveyed thought themselves friendlier, funnier, and better looking than average. And you go on to say that the average man seems to think he's two sit-ups away from dating a supermodel.
Right. So the interesting point here is on these measures of friendliness, athleticism, and good humor, the men in the study thought that they were 94 to 100% of them, depending on which of the variables you're looking at, thought that they were above average in this respect. Mm-hmm. And like, that is not how averages work, right? Yeah. That's not, you don't get 100% of people who are above average. And again, we see that this is something that has had a salutatory effect on humankind over eons of maturation and development. The fact that we're overconfident helps us get out of bed in the morning. It helped me talk to my wife, who I had no business talking to, right? I mean, it helped me to start a small business, even though most small businesses fail.
Right.
You know, overconfidence leads us to start restaurants and businesses. It leads us to do all manner of things that are good for society that are probabilistically speaking unlikely.
Yeah.
But we have to separate that from our investment lives. Like, you can be special, you can be overconfident in other places. You know, go take that big shot, go talk to the pretty girl, go start that business. But do not think that the rules don't apply to you when you're selecting funds or trying to make investment decisions, because they absolutely do.
Yeah. So you state that Wall Street is bizarro world in your view. I mean, every behavior you're used to using, which has created success in your life or has done other good things for you, don't necessarily work in the world of Wall Street. And give me an example of how that's so.
An easy example is just action. You know, if you think about trying to get stronger, so I'm trying to increase my bench press this year. That's one of my goals. And so what I'm doing is I'm lifting more weights. I'm spending more time at the gym. You know, if you want to become more intelligent, you should read more books and spend more time in libraries. But the findings suggest that if you want to make more money, the thing that you should do is nothing.
Nothing.
And we find, you know, in 19 different countries that I examined, we found that the more people traded, the more people watched financial news, the more people tuned in, the worse they did.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's profoundly counterintuitive to think that everywhere else in my life, more effort brings me more good things. But here in the world of money, I should, like, you know, blow up my TV and never check my statements and never trade. It's quite a thing to get your head around.
Well, as an investment advisor, which I am and have been doing for so many years, I think people expect me to do things. They expect me to trade more, to anticipate economic movements and stock movements and somehow kind of get them set up for protection or for opportunity. And my mantra is, you know, no, I mean, we've built this ship solidly. We've thought very hard and deep about what the structure is. We're not really, don't want to change it. We've kind of thought this through. And then I say, you know, doing nothing is the right thing to do, of course, unless you're a teenager. And then doing nothing is really the wrong thing for you to do. Get off the couch and go outside, you know. But there is this expectation that we should be doing something all the time.
Yeah. So on the one hand, you are absolutely right. And the counsel you're giving your clients is sound counsel. But you can also see why people go, you know, wow, like, I'm paying this person to tell me to do nothing. Like, well, yeah, kind of you are, you know.
And hold you back Yeah.
To hold your hand and to, you know, to see you through those difficult times.
Right.
And
right.
In The Laws of Wealth, you know, my last book, I talk about, spend a whole chapter talking about the research that shows that people who work with a financial advisor do about 3% better per year than those who don't. And over the course of 15 plus years, you know, it leads to people who've worked with an advisor for the long term having more than 2.5 times the wealth of their no advice peers. But when we looked at the drivers of that, it's basically saving someone from 3 or 4 catastrophically stupid decisions over a lifetime. And it's a funny thing to say, hey, I'm going to make you 3 times as rich by basically helping you to do nothing and not shoot yourself in the foot. And yet there, you know, the research bears it out.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Daniel Crosby, the book is The Behavioral Investor. We'll be back momentarily to finish this conversation. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomeranz Show. I'm back here with Daniel Crosby. He is the author of The Behavioral Investor, which is a look at how psychology should inform the art and science of investment management. We were talking about Wall Street and how really doing the opposite of what you think is right is probably the best way to go about operating on Wall Street. One very famous idea that came from Peter Lynch, who was a very successful money manager in the 80s, the Fidelity Magellan Fund, and wrote a number of books, is that he says that you should buy what you know. You should, you know, and you go into a store and you see a product that you really like and you understand the product, you know, you should buy that company. You say that that's not a good idea. Why is that?
Yeah, with profound deference to a guy who has a lot more money than me, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very bad idea. And there's 2 reasons why. So the first is that it's something we're already prone to doing. You know, if you look at Greece during the Greek debt crisis, the average Greek investor had more than 80% of his or her money in Greek stocks. And when you think about the Greek economy on the world stage, I mean, the Greek economy on the world stage is, you know, smaller than a small American state.
Yeah.
And you would never say, you know, invest 80% of your wealth in stocks from Rhode Island. And so you're very, very undiversified. And we even see that geographically. People in the Northeast tend to be overweight financials. People in the Midwest tend to be overweight agriculture. People already confuse what they know with what is good. And they already think that, well, since I've heard of this, it's not risky. And this leads people to be overweight their home country, overweight their industry. And if you think about a farmer in Kansas who is loaded up on agricultural stocks because that's what he's familiar with, his farm depends on farming, his livelihood depends on farming, his real estate depends on farming, and now his portfolio is overweight farming.
Right.
It's just you're taking excessively concentrated bets if you're buying what you know. The second reason is we found that financial education doesn't work when it's specific to holdings that you have in your portfolio. So if you teach an investor, you know, truths, high-level truths about stocks and bonds and different asset classes and how they work together and what a diversified portfolio looks like, that's powerful. People tend to remember and implement those learnings. But if you have someone who's holding Apple stock and you try and teach them about Apple stock, that gets filtered through the lens of, hey, I own this, I have my money in this, and it distorts the learning. So it's an interesting parallel. So there's a couple of reasons why I think you should not know what you own and why you shouldn't buy what you know, which is because you tend to already be overweight what you know, and knowing what you own paradoxically makes you hard to teach about to do with what you own.
That's fascinating. I think there's some argument that can be said by stating it a different way, and that is Buffett's idea of investing within your circle of competence. Is that different?
Yeah, so circle of competence investing reminds me of low ego, right? This is just saying, look, if you don't understand something, then don't venture into those waters. And I think that that's good advice for the average investor who may be tempted to get into something like cryptocurrency, which they have maybe heard of, but couldn't explain to you in a quick summary what the blockchain is or how it operates, right? So that sort of circle of competence investing would keep you out of that. Buffett would never say, if you work at Coca-Cola, load up on Coca-Cola stock because that's your bread and butter. So I think this idea of circle of competence is a check on ego, whereas what I'm talking about is a check on another human tendency, which is the status quo bias, which is this propensity to confuse what we know with what is safe.
Yeah, makes sense. So let's take a look at this problem with our lessening IQ under stress. This is important to me. So there's this poem from Rudyard Kipling, "If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs," and it goes on and on and on. Actually, I just reread it before this interview, and it's actually quite beautiful, and it describes a lot more things than just that. But that one quote is used a lot. "Then you will be a man, my son," is how it ends. It also says, by the way, "If you can wait and not be tired of waiting," which is another thesis in your book as well, is to be patient and to slow things down. Describe that for us.
Well, one of the reasons why we found that slowing down or sort of sleeping on a decision was impactful is because it lessens the degree to which we fall prey to status quo bias by about 32%. I think I'm getting that stat right. So again, people, when they're under pressure, tend to do what they've always done. They tend to do what's easy or comfortable, which may or may not be the right thing. So slowing down that process actually helps us to make more deliberative decisions, better decisions. I also cite research in the book, which was one of the more fascinating studies I found, which found that people who are bilingual make better decisions when they're thinking in their non-preferred language. So if you, if you speak Spanish and English and, you know, you have to make a big decision and English is your native language, you may try and mull that over in Spanish because it causes you, again, to be less emotional, more intentional, more deliberative, slower, and that led people to make better financial decisions. So again, slowing down the sort of reflexive knee-jerk reactions, which we all have around money, is nothing but a good thing.
So sleeping on it is a good idea?
Sleeping on it is a good idea. Talking it over with a trusted advisor is a good idea. Thinking about it in Spanish is a good idea.
Lots of luck with that, for me anyway.
For me too.
You know, sometimes when I'm driving to work, I'll have CNBC radio on and, you know, I'll hear someone spell out a thesis for something. And the worst thing that can really happen is that I really understand what he's saying. Because to me, you know, that makes perfect sense. The first thing I want to do is come in the office. I want to do that. I want to execute that because I think I understand it because the person has made such an eloquent case for it. I do nothing. And what I realize is that there is so much behind understanding what this person was actually saying that, you know, a 30-second clip and then going to commercial is really not enough. So one of the dangers is the thought that you've understood something so completely, so quickly. Has that ever crossed your mind?
Yeah, so I have a whole piece in the book where I talk about how we think in stories, and I cite research out of Princeton that shows when two people are sitting across from each other, you and I are sitting across from each other, and they do maps of our brain, right? They hook us up to an fMRI machine, and our brains don't look altogether too similar because we're different guys having different thoughts. But then if you start to tell me a story, our brains effectively sync up. You know, the brain activity of our two brains mirrors one another. And it's effectively as though you've opened up my head and dropped your brain in my head. So narrative and stories are enormously powerful and very seductive, but they're usually far too simple. And, you know, what I love to do is look at my my iPhone stocks app in the course of a given day, like many we've had in the last month or so that have been relatively volatile. And you'll say, you know, it will start the morning up 0.5% and it'll stay, you know, stocks rise on enthusiasm about midterm elections. And then, you know, you close the day out down 1% and it says, you know, stocks fall on terror over midterms. And it's like, you know, well, which was it, guys?
Yeah,
you know,
they don't know.
So we're always putting stories, you know, stories are chasing reality. They're not driving reality. They're chasing post hoc, what has already occurred.
Yes.
And the more we can understand that and not fall prey to these seductive narratives, the better off we'll be.
Oh, unfortunately, we are out of time. Fascinating stuff. Daniel Crosby, author of The Behavioral Investor. Anybody who wants to invest and wants to get a handle on it and get it right this time should check out this book, The Behavioral Investor. Daniel, what a pleasure. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
To hear this interview again, don't forget to go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where you will get this and all of our interviews either in transcript form or summary form, or you can actually listen to it at your convenience. And you'll find that at stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And you're in the studio today.
In the house.
It's so great to have you. We've talked many weeks about prices and sales. They're slowing. They're stabilizing. Where are they now? What is the National Association of Realtors saying about real estate in America?
We haven't heard this word in a while. Home sales have flattened.
Flattened the sales, so they're not growing.
They're not growing.
Actually, are they contracting?
Not yet. Well, it depends on how, yes, if you're not growing and you're flattening, you're contracting.
Yeah, you know, you sound like an economist. On the one hand, and then on the other hand,
right.
You know.
But flat's not bad.
No, look, you don't always have to grow.
That's,
you know?
Right.
It's better than to be flat than necessarily to be down.
And we need the inventory, so it's a welcome relief.
Yeah. Well, you know, that brings up the question as to whether buyers are aware of this relaxation or this more inventory. Are they waiting or what's going on?
It's interesting that you ask that question because I was with someone yesterday and he told me that this was happening. I'm like, how do you know? I thought I was only the special person. You must listen to us on the radio.
Oh.
But no, I think consumers out there are starting to see that. And they've done surveys, Steve. The surveys show that the consumers say it's a great time to sell, but not a good time to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say, well, what are you waiting for? Because if you think about it, interest rates are rising. So if you're a buyer and you're going to wait, you're going to pay more for that house. Even if the prices are declining or flattening, it's going to cost you more.
Anyway, it's your home and it's a question of affordability.
Absolutely.
You have to live somewhere. If you want to live in a home, make it your own for whatever the reasons are. Not everybody should be a homeowner. There's reasons for renters, but if you want a home, literally there's no time like the present because you can't forecast the future.
That's right.
And I know you're always saying the best time to buy is
now,
and the best time to sell is
now.
Yeah, and it's not like you're biased or anything.
No, not at all.
You have an agenda.
No agenda.
It's not hidden. That's
no,
the difference.
It's definitely not hidden.
Okay.
Transparency.
You know what? A word I haven't heard in a long time, especially with regards to the housing market, is the bubble.
Ooh, the bubble.
Does the National Association of Realtors, the NAR, not the NRA, the NAR, do they say that we're in a bubble or not?
No, we're not. We're not even anywhere close to a bubble. The fundamentals are not there. What we experience, I mean, we have still a very strong, stable housing market.
Yeah.
We do not have the subprime loans that took us down. That was all fueled by ad loans and just a whole different
easy money.
Easy money,
right.
Easy come, easy go.
Yeah.
Not going to happen.
That's right. So, you know, first of all, these bubbles are extremely rare, number one. Number two, you don't really ever know you're in a bubble
until afterwards,
right? And this, I've been saying for so many years, is we are not in a housing bubble. We're not in a stock market bubble.
Right.
Those are different kinds of conditions. So disabuse yourself of that thought if you're worried about that.
That's right.
Let's talk about their forecast for 2019. Now we're talking about the NAR again. So what are they expecting for 2019?
They're saying it's going to be very boring, meaning stable.
Stable.
They're predicting a stable market.
So many houses sell in general for the year, like
right.
5 million and change or whatever.
Correct.
So if more houses are selling, that's when they're saying it's growing. But if stable means it's kind of hovering around
the same number.
The average number.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So that's that's what that means. I mean, we do actually have some numbers that reflect that. For 2018, 5,345,000 homes were sold.
Right.
And purchased, right? That was a decrease from 2017, where 5.5 million.
Right.
So there was a decline there. And they're forecasting that to increase from 5,345,000 to 5,400,000. So a slight increase next year.
Right. It also means slight increase in home appreciation.
Oh, that in, okay.
So that's also being predicted.
This is the value
of your home.
Okay.
So
right.
Your home won't be appreciating as much as it has in the past.
So that's something that I think we can state pretty much categorically, that the big increases in home prices are behind us.
Yes, very much so.
Talking about home prices, the amount of homes selling for over $1 million has been rising.
That's right.
Yeah, so let's discuss that. Tell us a little bit about the numbers of homes, what areas of the country are seeing that. Go ahead.
What we're looking at is there was a 400,000 increase in the number of $1 million plus homes that sold throughout the United States. We're looking at about 3 million nationally is what is out there in $1 million plus properties, which represents close to 4% of the overall market.
All right. So when you look at all the homes out there available, all the housing stock, let's call it.
Right.
About 4% of that are homes over $1 million. So if you think of a bell curve, that would be the one side of the tail.
Of
the bell curve, about 4%. That sounds kind of normal to me. However, it's different in different areas because these are averages and averages don't really tell the complete story.
So they're all jammed in certain parts of the country. So California, of course, being it.
Yeah. We've got some numbers here. So listen to this. In San Jose, California, the share of $1 million homes in October of 2017 was 55.7% of the homes in San Jose, California, 2017, were over $1 million. In 2018, in October, 70% of the homes in that area were $1 million or more.
That's crazy.
Wow.
And then you look at San Francisco. San Francisco was in October of 2017, it was 67%. Today, it's 80%.
Yeah, 80% of the homes in San Francisco.
Now I understand why everyone's homeless over there.
No, absolutely.
I mean, seriously.
It's not funny.
I'm not laughing.
Now everybody goes to Honolulu when they want to move there.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a bargain.
So what is the share of $1 million homes in Honolulu?
It's only 20%.
Oh, it's nothing.
So you got 80% that you can afford.
Of course, the national average is 4,
right.
And they're at 20, but comparatively speaking. What about, let's say, New York? We have Long Island, New York. What's the share there?
Yeah, I thought, you know, not being from New York, I thought it would be a lot higher than this, but it's only 10%.
Well, I think if you think about Manhattan, which is not in this list, on this list, it seems like there's more apartments there that sell over $1 million.
Right.
You know, than and is reflected here about $1 million homes in Long Island anyway.
Yeah, I guess I always thought Long Island was all very wealthy, but must be parts of Long Island.
Well, New York's a big place. Now that Amazon's going to move their headquarters partially there, whatever. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, and she can be located at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. If you've lived in South Florida for many years, or maybe you've just taken up residence, I'm sure you've heard the name and the legacy of H. Wayne Huizenga. Wayne Sr., as he is known, was the owner of the Miami Dolphins. He was the founder of Blockbuster Video and the creator of so many other businesses. Now, I was fortunate to have known Wayne casually. I interviewed him in 2005, and you know, as I said recently, after replaying that interview after his passing, I came away from that interview extremely impressed with both his honesty and his down-to-earth demeanor. And so I can say the same thing about the gentleman who is here in the studio with me today. He bears the name and the legacy, and he's graciously agreed to discuss his own life, living under the umbrella and sometimes shadow of the man referred to as Wayne Sr. My guest is Wayne Huizenga Jr. Welcome to the show, Wayne.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Well, first of all, thanks for coming in. I know you're a very, very busy guy, and points out your graciousness to come into the studio with us today. You know, most of us have an idealized view of what it would be like to grow up in a situation as you did. A son of a person who has amassed great wealth, who's owned 250-foot yachts and football teams and the like. But your story is different. It's actually quite different. It's quite a lot more down to earth. Let's begin with your early childhood. Wayne was married to your mom, Joyce, and you lived in Chicago. And just take us through there and then how you ended up coming down to South Florida.
Yes, well, I was born in South Florida. My folks divorced when I was five. My mom decided to move back to Chicago, where her and Wayne Sr. were from. And we, my brother Scott and I grew up on a six-lane thoroughfare and a house that had five bedrooms, or five rooms, rather, if you counted the back porch. And Mom used to say it's small, but it's always clean and filled with love. So it was quite different than I think what most people would think.
And what years were those?
That was in 1966 until 72 or 73.
So you were born in South Florida, but you lived in Chicago and in that house that you just referred to. And then your parents were divorced when you were five. And then how did you end up coming down here?
Dad remarried Marty, who was wonderful. And I was blessed to have two mothers, as I lost my natural mother early, one day after she turned 63. We went ahead and it was kind of a decision that Dad was going to move back. And so Mom decided that she had had enough of Chicago and she was ready to move back. So we all kind of moved back around within about a year of each other.
So you came down with your mom.
Yes.
And Wayne Sr. had already been remarried, and he was establishing a life down here. So where did you live?
We lived in Fort Lauderdale at first, as well as Dad did. And then we ended up relocating up to Palm Beach County would have been in 76 or 77.
So your dad was pretty busy.
He was extremely busy building waste management with Uncle Dean, with Dean Buntruck and, and Uncle Peter Heisinger.
You know, I remember going up to their executive suites in Fort Lauderdale and seeing a black and white photo of Wayne. And it was at the New York Stock Exchange, and it was the Wayne and kind of the executive team, and they were beaming with pride. You know, you could definitely see that. This is the first time I think he had really kind of ventured into that. Do you remember those days at all?
I don't remember those days. I remember the pictures very well, and I remember the people in those pictures because I kind of grew up with them, and we'd go, and I guess today you'd call it kind of a play date, but it was really a dad going and having meetings with John Melk or with some of the other founders, and they had children, and so we'd all kind of hang out or whatnot while our parents were meeting and doing business and whatnot. So I don't remember the listing that was in 72, I believe, and so I would have only been 11.
So he traveled a lot. He flew around from place to place a lot. So how often did you actually see him?
In the early days, not a lot. There were some years where I might only see him three or four times, and it'd be a day here or two or three days there, and it was cherished times after the divorce. And some say that the pain of the divorce was what really drove him. I don't know if that's true or not. I think he was very driven regardless, but I think that, you know, not having the kids and having his bride around in the early days was, okay, you know what? What else do I have to really do but work?
Yeah.
He was never a big guy to play around and whatnot.
But originally, he really wasn't that interested in working. He came out of the Army, didn't really know what to do. You know, there was the garbage business, and it's like, I don't know if it was his uncle or his father says, come on, come into the garbage business. He was like, no, I don't really think I don't want to do that. But, you know, obviously there was something inside him that drove him. He was also, you know, extra savvy and smart. And he was able to take that to multiple levels higher. Now, at what point did you realize that there was a kind of a money magic here? You were starting to be surrounded by large yachts. He bought this property off in the Isles of Fort Lauderdale. What was that like for you?
That time frame was really when I was in high school. He bought an old house that had built in the 20s. It was built in the 20s, and Los Olas wasn't like Los Olas is today.
Right.
I mean, it was still a neat, you know, situation, but it was really when I was in college and graduating from college that he retired from waste management, got involved with Blockbuster Video, and really started to make significantly more money, and then got into sports, and that's when all of a sudden everybody knew who he was.
Yeah.
Before, he was kind of the business community knew him, but the world didn't know him as they got to today. And it was quite eye-opening. And I remember very well being in the offices shortly after we launched the Marlins and him telling us, Bob Henninger and I were together, and him saying, you know, the press won't always be this friendly.
Yeah.
One day it's going to change. And I remember looking at Bob and thinking, wow, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
You know, it's a golden child here. And sure enough, you know, within a couple of years, with sports and all.
Well,
it can
selling
be so fickle.
The Marlins and all of that, it was very controversial.
Yeah.
And kind of broke the unspoken rule of home team. It's not just a business. You know, there was more to it.
And that's all fine and good until you take and field the team, and you still don't fill the stadium until you're playing the Braves, you know, and on your way to the World Series playing the Indians. But that year we lost $34 million of cash.
Yeah.
Everybody goes, sure, but I was there, you know. I said, man, that's, you know, and the conversation had been, if the fans don't come out when we have a winning team, then when are they really going to come out? And and unfortunately, I think we've continued to see that in South Florida, there's so many things to do that sitting for a baseball game in the middle of summer is tough.
Right, and they're still having a challenge making it a go, that's for sure.
Yeah, and a beautiful facility that they built
the
down there. And
it's
unbelievable,
So, you were in your teens, and they were living off of Los Olas. You were still living where?
I was living in North Palm Beach with my mom.
Okay.
In a townhouse there. And
I'd
go from middle income, and then on the weekends drive down, or we'd boat down sometimes, and go to and then back to middle income again.
Right.
So it was very interesting.
Right. Now, you worked for your dad in those businesses, right? First of all, you worked at Waste Management, and we were talking earlier, and you know, there's a story that I have because I was working construction in the summer in the 70s, and I remember driving a truck to the dump and thinking, this place really stinks. I hate this place. And your comment to me, well, it smelled bad to me, but it smelled like money to you guys, right?
That's it. Whenever we used to, people would say, oh, sure, that place smells bad. And Dad would look at me and say, it smells like money, doesn't it, Junior? And I go, yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. But you also got involved when Blockbuster started to take off. Tell us a little bit about that.
I graduated college in 85. I worked with my grandfather for a little while. And then I went to work with Wayne Sr. and Blockbuster. And it was still very small. I helped to open the first three stores down here in Florida. Got to travel and help open the first store in London internationally. And got to spend a lot of time with him on working special projects and traveling, looking at acquisitions and meeting the top people in the industry like Ron Castell and some of the others. And it was a great, great time.
He didn't want to do it at first. He had to really be super convinced over and over again. Because at that time, those video stores, they had a pornographic section in the back. It was just a kind of a different kind of business. This idea of kind of centralizing these businesses and putting them under one logo and everything, that wasn't really something that I think he was really understood until he really got to understand it.
No, you know? you're absolutely right. It was a perception thing that it was not at all what Blockbuster was. And then one day John Melk cornered him in Chicago at the airplane and said, I'm not going to move my car out of the way of the airplane until you take a ride with me. And he showed him the store, and it was everything but what you described. It was bright and well lit and tons of videos. And he was impressed. And then he showed him the financials and he said, this is incredible. And they made the three of them, John Melk and Wayne Sr. and Don Flynn made an investment and took control of the company.
Yeah. There's so much to that story. I'm speaking with Wayne Huizinga Jr., the son of Wayne Huizinga Sr., of course, and we're talking about Wayne a little bit and also what it was like to kind of grow up in that world. It's not necessarily, you know, just kind of all peaches and cream. There's a lot going on in life here, and I think it's really quite fascinating. I was around and involved in a tangential way. You mentioned, there's a gentleman you mentioned before that I know very well, and I was around for the sale of the Blockbuster deal. I'm an investment advisor, so I was very much into what was going on, watching Sumner Redstone from Viacom, and he was buying Paramount, and he needed all this cash flow, and there was this gem of cash flow called Blockbuster Video. But I don't think Wayne really wanted to sell it initially, right?
No, it was not his first choice. I think that he saw a lot of legs left. But again, it was about what's best for the investors. And we met a lot of regular people that bought stock because they believed in him in Fort Lauderdale at first and then around the country, and they'd come to the shareholders meetings. And so many times we heard, you know, older ladies come up and say, Wayne, you know, we love you, and because we bought stock, my grandchildren are going to college for free because I made so much money. Thank you. And so when Viacom came along with that kind of an offer, over $8 billion at that time for the purchase of the company, he said, you know, it's not what I want to do, but it's the right thing to do for the shareholders.
Yeah. Also, when you're thinking about the amount of money that Blockbuster is making, it takes quite a number of years. The profits add up to $8 billion. So you kind of get this, you get this early payment, you know? So
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, there was no doubt that it was a good deal and it was the right thing to do. But his heart saw so many other things. And I have no doubt that had he not stayed in, you know, that maybe Blockbuster would have been Netflix. It would have been a natural extension.
Well, that was the big challenge back then, because people were seeing the fact that the idea of going into a store and getting a DVD was going away, but he sold out well before that. Let's talk about your current business. What are you doing currently? What's occupying most of your time?
I have a super yacht marina and repair facility, well, two of them in West Palm Beach and Riviera Beach called Rybovich, and that was the family name. The business was started in 1919. We acquired the control of the business in 2004 and have rebuilt the majority of the existing facility, and we berth vessels now to well over 300 feet, and you see a lot of celebrities in their vessels when you come to visit us, and that's probably my favorite business, but we still have some legacy businesses as well that I manage with the guys at the holdings company, Bob and Chris and Alex, for the kids and that type of thing. But Blockbuster is my favorite. I love the water.
You mean the Rybovich?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thinking about the $8 billion and going, I don't know that I'm going to get there with Rybovich. Yeah. But
it's a slog. So this marina is one of just very few around the world because it has the ability to handle these very large ships. So what other marinas of this size are you competing with? What's the closest one?
There's a few down in Fort Lauderdale, but they cannot berth the same size vessels as we do. So our competition is really international. Mm-hmm. And if you were to look at vessels over 150 feet, we berth more vessel nights than anywhere else in the world, more than Monaco, more than anywhere in France or in Italy or in Spain. So we have more large vessel nights in our marina than anywhere else in the world.
So tell us a little bit about your family. You're married, and give us a little insight there.
I married my childhood sweetheart, Fonda, and we met when we were 15, thanks to her mother, Edie. I have been blessed with 27 wonderful years with her this past October. I have four incredible children, Savannah, who is married now for 3 years, my son, Wayne III, who just graduated from Wake Forest and is working with me. He's 23, and I have two younger children with Fonda. I joke that I had to beg for those because she was an only child. And when I asked her parents, they said, well, we only had one because we got it right the first time. And if she were here, she'd say, absolutely. And she is wonderful. She's a biomedical engineer and an electrical engineer. And after some begging and prodding, I was blessed to have Garrett, who's named after my grandfather, his great-grandfather, Wayne Sr.'s father, and Ainsley Mignon. And Ainsley is 16 now and loves to play lacrosse and is playing on the team that's ranked fifth in the nation right now.
So you're very involved with your business, your immediate family. You're still seeing Wayne's family and your stepsisters and the likes?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all going up to Pam's for Thanksgiving. And that was a promise that we made to Mom before she passed, that we would keep the family together. Mm-hmm. You know, both of my mothers pressed that family is number one, and you only get one family, and you need to stay together. So we'll all be together in Stuart for Thanksgiving, and we were up in Holland, Michigan, on the lake this summer over July 4th with the rest of the Heisinger family, and we had a great time for our Heisinger family reunion, and we're big on tradition and on family.
That's wonderful. My guest, Wayne Heisinger Jr. To hear this interview again, and if you have any question about what we've just discussed, visit our website at stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for a brief rundown on important topics and interviews like this, where you can see them every single week in your inbox and decide whether this is something you want to listen to, whether you'd like to read the transcript, or we even have a summary of it as well. Sign up for that. And the website is stevepomerantz.com. Wayne Jr., thanks so much for joining us.
Steve, thank you for the opportunity again.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.